the swaddled baby and sprinting off into the brush behind the village. By now, torches were being tossed at houses, and the village was ablaze. Black smoke scudded across the land, and the simple dust streets were stained with blood. All within lay dead. Hattu eyed Volker with disgust. The sun was casting long shadows by the time the rest of the army arrived at the village.
"We saw the smoke,"
Nuanza said, arriving first at a run.
"What happened?"
Kurunta panted close behind.
"Where are the Kaskans?"
"There were no Kaskans, sir," Hattu replied. "Just this village of simple men." Kurunta and Nuanza's faces fell aghast.
"How? Why?"
Kurunta stammered. "The wolves played no part in this," he started. Then saw the royal carriage drawing up alongside the wrecked village. The curtain was drawn back. Father lay inside, feeble but propped up to sitting. His eyes cut through everything, glaring at Hattu, blood and smoke-stained, standing amongst the bodies of men, women, and children. Muwa arrived next.
"What is this?"
he gasped, eyes bulging at the horror of the slaughter.
"What happened?"
Later that evening, the army camped on a broad, dry heath at the far end of the forked valley. The ringed spear palisade was lined with a triple watch, so sure were they of Pitaga's closeness. The sun was dropping towards the horizon when Volker entered his bivouac tent, slid off his boots and red cloak, and had an attendant unbuckle his greenscale corslet.
"Clean it,"
he snapped.
"Your helm, too,"
the slave offered.
"I'll clean it myself,"
he growled. The slave scuttled off. Volker waited a few moments, then checked nobody was looking before unbuckling his chin strap and lifting off his horned helm. For a moment he caught a glimpse of the strange creature in the dull, blood-spattered reflection of the helm. As he wiped and buffed it with a rag, the visage became clearer. A handsome man with a fiery, scabrous red cap of gristle, veins and ragged sinew clinging to a white dome of skull. The angry Sherden people who called him a kingslayer had meant to skin him whole, but they'd only got as far as peeling off his scalp and cutting away his genitals before he had broken free. He carefully wrapped a headscarf around the old ugly wound, the rim of the linen overlapping the peeled skin, and knotted it at the back. Now he could see only a handsome fellow.
"Those ingrates should have hailed you as new king of the Sherden,"
he smiled, his copper earrings shivering with each word.
"But you will not be denied. You will have a throne of your own one day soon."
"Who are you talking to?"
a voice interrupted his thoughts. He swung round to see Nuanza, his jutting triple hails of hair almost scraping the tent ceiling. The bowman had always eyed him askance, but now his gaze seemed more prying than usual.
"My closest friend," Volker grinned,
then turned to the small table that bore a jug of watered wine and a few cups.
"Time to wash the dust from our throats,"
he offered. Nuanza eyed the relative fineries with a slight wrinkle of the nose.
"No, I prefer to drink my wine from a skin, sitting by the fire with my men. I find they respect me more for it."
"Ha! The asceticism of the Hittites,"
Volker mocked.
"If not wine, then bread?"
"No. First we scout the countryside."
"Isn't that the job of scouts?"
Volker chuckled.
"Normally. But the Lord of the Mountains is close. Too close. I want to put my own eyes on the land, to see every hill, meadow, and river for myself. You're coming with me."
"Am I?"
Volker said, straightening up to express his height advantage. Nuanza was utterly unfazed.
"The Labana's orders," he said with a smirk.
Alarmed, Volker looked past Nuanza, towards the royal pavilion.
"The Labana is well? Well enough to communicate?"
"Far from it. He's managed only a few words since we made camp. The order I've just passed on to you."
Just then the slave came back, presenting Volker with his now gleaming armor.
"Very well."
Volker shrugged and slid on his boots again. He had bargained on having this time to think, to plan. Pitaga's last messenger bird had come in at dusk the previous evening, a white raven, a rare bird. It meant one thing, as they had agreed when last they met.
If a white bird comes, lead them to Nerik, the land of the waning moon.
A challenge indeed. He would think on the ride, he decided.
The horses are being readied by the camp's western entrance, and my servant is bringing water there. And Prince Muwa has gifted me a quiver of his goose-feather arrows, too. Go there and meet my servant, then wait for me.
Nuanza gave him another of those dry looks, then left. A short while later, the pair rode on horseback along a dry stream bed, veining a rocky gully, 2 danna west of the camp, each man's head swinging steadily back and forth along the horizon. The echo of their horses' hooves played tricks on the mind, conjuring images of many hundreds of steeds in pursuit. But they were alone.
Pitaga has drawn southwest, heading for the hill routes, Volker sighed, removing his helm to stroke the linen headscarf underneath. All the tracks we have found say it is so.
Southwest, Nuanza mused. That would take him to the basin of Old Nerik.
Volker tried to hold back the grin that was tugging at his lips.
But that's probably what he wants us to think, Nuanza concluded flatly. We keep scouting until the sun is down.
With that, he returned to scouring his edge of the gully. Volker scowled at the back of the general's head. If he was to bring down the royal house of Hattusa and take the Grey Throne, he would have to think carefully about who, if any, he would allow to live. He would have to begin a dynasty of his own. He thought of the mangled and useless lump of scar tissue the angry Sherdan people had left him with between his legs.
Well, perhaps not a dynasty entirely of my own, he mused.
His 2 fellow Sherdan would be needed to spread their seed amongst the high-born women of Hattusa in his stead. It would be a challenging time. In any case, he mused, when that time came, there would be little need for irritating men like Nuanza.
And here we are, out in the wilds, just the 2 of us.
A shadow scudded across them. Both men looked up.
A vulture, Volker cooed. And we're not corpses yet.
No, that's a falcon, Nuanza said with a chuckle. He's been following us all the way from the camp. Prince Hattu's hunting bird.
Preying on men?
Watching over us, Hattu would claim. She has had her moments, to be fair, Nuanza chuckled.
They rode on in silence. Volker shot Nuanza sideways glances, and he sensed the master archer do the same in return. The balmy heat and rhythmic cicada song lulled them into a sense that only they existed in this empty land, until the sound of crumbling rock brought both their heads switching round to the gully side. For an instant, a face was up there, on the ledge, and then it was gone. Volker hoisted his trident like a javelin, but Nuanza threw up a hand to catch his arm.
Easy! It's just a boy, he said. I'll deal with this.
Nuanza rode on ahead to the end of the gully, then wheeled round to ride back along the low side. Volker watched, his eyes tapering, as the bowman slowed and slid from his steed, then approached the spot where the boy had been, speaking soft, soothing words.
At ease, lad. Nobody will harm you.
The boy rose timidly from his hiding place, and Volker saw how he held a swaddled baby, which began to cry. Nuanza fell to one knee, handing the boy a strip of soldier bread and a tiny vial of honey for the baby. Nuanza seemed to be winning the lad over. Volker sighed and slid his horned helm back on. As soon as he did so, the boy froze, eyes falling upon him. His face fell at once, and he backed away from Nuanza, who whispered at him, tried to calm him. After a hurried exchange of words, the lad turned and ran, off along the ledge, and then scrambled up a snaking track into the hills. Nuanza stood, watching him go, then turned and remounted his horse. Shortly, Nuanza cantered back along the gully floor to join up with Volker again.
Strange. A boy and a babe on their own out here, Volker remarked.
Aye, strange indeed, was all Nuanza said.
They rode in silence. It was some time before Nuanza spoke again.
That town you churned into the dirt earlier today. Tell me about it.
Now that was Prince Hattu's victory,
Volker corrected him. Nuanza smiled wryly.
Only because you reported it as such. The prince's sword and spear were clean. And somehow he and the mountain wolves were the ones to suffer Prince Muwa's anger over the whole affair. Condemned to half rations when they played no part in the slaughter.
And they will eat properly again soon. The victory was more important. Don't you want Hattu to breed a strong reputation? Victory means little to me, but to the prince...
That was no victory. And no man would want a reputation for such an act, Nuanza said. Why did you spur the Leopard Clan men to behave like that?
You are a general too, Volker reasoned. You understand that once inside an enemy town, soldiers cannot be restrained.
Aye, that is true, Nuanza conceded. But they did not slay soldiers in there. Just families. They cut down everyone. Everyone.
Volker felt a streak of warmth at the completeness of the job. Too many within the Hattanzuan village had seen his face in the past.
Well, almost everyone, Nuanza added.
Volker gripped the horse's reins a little more tightly, his steed slowing just a fraction.
Hmm?
That boy and the baby escaped the town, and have been hiding in these hills in the hours since, Nuanza replied. It took a long time to reassure him I meant him no harm. I told him we could feed and tend to him and the babe in camp. He seemed to trust me for a moment.
Volker felt Nuanza's gaze on the side of his face, unblinking.
Then he said he froze with fright, Nuanza continued. Stammered something about the bull man.
My helm, Volker laughed.
Nuanza did not laugh.
The bull man, I asked. Do you know what he said?
Enlighten me, Volker said.
The bull man, the one who killed my parents today, Nuanza continued. The one who roamed with Lord Pitaga 4 summers past.
Volker continued to laugh, long and loud, while his mind flashed with 1,000 replies.
Tell me, Volker, why would a boy say something like that? 3 summers ago we found you bound by an ant's nest. We saved you. You told us you had sailed east that year from distant lands.
Volker's laughter tapered off, but his smile remained.
As I say, Nuanza, we may never have seen eye to eye, but you and I are generals, and a good general should be suspicious.
He lifted his water skin from his belt to take a sip from it.
I should think of this day, but the next too, and most of all, expect the unexpected.
He dropped the water skin, revealing the small copper knife he had drawn unseen, then hammered the blade towards Nuanza's broad, unarmored chest. But the master archer, fast as a lion, threw up a forearm, deflecting the blow, then thrust an elbow into Volker's face. Volker felt sky and earth switch places as he toppled from his mount, his red cloak blinding and entangling him. With a crunch, he landed, then scrambled back, swinging his trident from his back and instinctively dropping into a warrior's crouch. With a thud, Nuanza dismounted, tearing his sword from his belt.
And traitors like you, Nuanza snarled through gritted teeth, should be strung up by their balls. Throw down your trident and I might let you live, but only so you may kneel before the king's wagon and confess to him all you and Pitaga have planned.
And the king will find out all we have in store for him and his army in good time,
Volker replied, flexing his fingers on the trident shaft, his eyes tapering to crescents.
However, you, my friend, are done for.
Am I? Nuanza said stonily.
Volker's eyes widened as Nuanza sprang for him like a bolt of lightning, curved blade coming round for his neck. He ducked, feeling the sword scuff across the tip of his helm, ripping helm and headscarf off. He felt the heat of the sun on his grotesque dome of skull, scar tissue and wiry strips of vein. Nuanza laughed once, without a grain of mirth.
Oh, you are a web of lies and deception, he scoffed.
Alight with indignation, Volker rushed for Nuanza, trident trained on his belly. Nuanza's face fell, and he let one leg buckle to roll left, before leaping back to his feet, twirling his sword in one hand.
I knew there was something odd about you. Karunta said you were just an arsehole, and you are. but I knew there was more to it. You were behind Zeta's death. You've been behind every misfortune we have encountered so far. The king will decide your fate, and I can assure you it will be grim. Perhaps an ant's nest. It would seem right.
Volker felt his heart rap madly as Nuanza stalked towards him, fearless of his hovering trident points. Panic almost consumed him before he spotted a root growing along the gully floor, running under his feet and Nuanza's. He dropped to his haunches to grasp the root, hauling it up with all his strength. In a cloud of dirt and debris, the rope-like vine whipped up, hooking Nuanza's ankle and throwing him onto his back. The impact sent the Hittite general's sword spinning from his hand and across the dirt, past Volker. Volker brought his trident tip swinging round, sure it was certain to pierce the general's heart. But Nuanza sprung up like a cat, unhitching the bow from his back in a flash.
"Never force an archer onto his bow,"
Nuanza growled, taking two steps back from the stunned Volker and reaching up to his back quiver, flicking the leather lid open. Then his face fell as he clutched at thin air. Volker grinned like a shark.
"Never leave a Sherden alone with your weapons," he purred. "Your arrows lie in the dirt, back at the camp gate."
Then he lunged forward, plunging the central tip of the trident into Nuanza's breast. With a gasp, the master archer dropped his bow. Volker rammed the trident in fully. Three thick runnels of blood poured from the wounds, and General Nuanza sank to his knees, mouth agape.
"And it is to the dirt with you, bowman."
He drew the trident back, and Nuanza thumped forward dead. Volker panted, his mind already picking over the detail of how he might falsify his report, when, from a pace away, the most unholy shriek sounded. He swung round to see Arrow, that damned falcon, flying in a tight circle around him. Like a lizard's tongue, he swept out a hand to swat it away, but the falcon was too quick, banking clear. The falcon settled a safe distance away on the gully edge, looking down at Nuanza's corpse and keening. Volker thought then of the two brother princes, so hateful now. He smiled, closed one eye, and lifted his trident like a javelin. Chapter 19. Brothers Asunder. Summer 1300 BC. As the last vestiges of light slipped from the land, the wolves sat around their campfire. Hattu poked and prodded at the single pot cooking over the fire. After a hard day marching, the meagre half-ration of spelt to make porridge would barely feed the 60 men. But Muwa had been insistent on the punishment ration. Hattu had challenged him to punish Volker too, but his brother had refused to even listen to him. He stirred the thin porridge and scooped a helping out with a spoon, passing it to Dagon.
"He stood up for us. That's what matters," Dagon said, sensing Hattu's mood.
"You spoke well," Tanku agreed, taking the next bowl offered.
Hattu's teeth ground together behind closed lips as he sat down with his porridge. It had taken all his reserves of willpower not to scream at Muwa, to demand apology for the unjust blame the chosen prince had yoked him with. Even now the sight of his brother across the camp, the sound of his voice, or of others saluting him, grated like salt on broken skin. He barely realized he was holding his bowl with a throttle-like grip, until the clay vessel broke with a thin clunk, the paltry porridge ration seeping away into the earth.
"Not hungry,"
Kistner remarked cautiously, one eyebrow arching.
"Not even slightly," Hattu replied.
When a commotion erupted at the western entrance to the camp, Hattu rose, Tanku and Dagon standing with him. At the entrance, a short and heavily patrolled gap in the spear palisade, many hundreds of soldiers had clustered around an arriving horseman.
"Volker,"
Dagon said.
"Did he not set out with Nuanza?"
Tanku said, speaking for them all. Hattu set down his porridge and pushed into the crowd, the wolves gathering in his wake.
"Where is the Master Bowman?"
The Sherden warrior's gaze found him and the wolves amongst the crowd. His forlorn eyes answered the question.
"A knot of Pitaga's hillmen fell upon us just west. He fought like a lion, but..."
He stopped and shook his head once. As Volker ranged past them towards the royal pavilion, many others clustered around him, the questions coming thick and fast. Hattu, Tanku, and Dagon watched the space the Galmasedi had ridden through, mute, disbelieving. Nuanza had been there always at father's side. Now he was gone.
"The bowman is dead,"
Dagon said, his words laced with disbelief. The men of the camp cried out in lament as words spread through the camp. Hattu saw Karunta nearby, staring, his craggy face suddenly like a lost boy's upon hearing the news. It was doubtful whether the haggard general had any true friends, but in Ruba, and now Nuanza, he had lost two age-old comrades on this wretched march. The laments soon turned to angry chatter and arguments. The leader of the Blaze had been slain, some snapped. Pataga's forces must be just a short way west, others argued, vulnerable and within striking distance at last. Soon the generals gathered by a large fire near the royal pavilion, with an audience of thousands of soldiers, Hattu and the wolves included. Muwa stood before the flames, his broad face uplit by the fire. Using a stick, he traced a crude crescent like a waning moon in the dirt, the open end facing east. He then made a dot, just northeast of this crescent. "We are here," Muwa said, gesturing to the dot. "Going by the location at which Volker and Nuanza were ambushed, Pataga has swung towards the southwest. I fear he now retreats across the nearby hills," he said, tracing the stick across the upper arm of the crescent and into the circle of space within, "and towards the basin of Nerik. If he crosses that basin and once again melts into the soaring mountains," he concluded, indicating towards the lower arm of the crescent, "then we cannot hope to continue the pursuit."
"And do not dismay, Tukanti," Volker interrupted. "And the basin of Nerik will be Pataga's grave."
All stared at him, rapt. The Galmasedi sank to his haunches to gesture to the interior of the crescent.
"I have heard many tales of the place. Flat, broad plains. Fine terrain for Hittite forces. For chariots. Not so good for mountain men."
A regimental chief of the now leaderless Blaze Division stroked his jaw, his eyes brightening.
"If we can get there first."
Volker grinned, nodding. Another chief beat a fist against his knee.
"Block the southerly routes into the mountains. Trap him on those plains.
We can fall upon him as he tries to escape. He will be wandering into a pen,"
agreed a third. A chorus of cheer and pride rippled around the fire. Coulter gazed into the flames, tugging at his forked beard.
"A pen for whom? When does the fox become the hound?"
Volker glared at him for a moment, then swiped a hand through the air and scoffed.
"Now is not the time for procrastination, old horse. With every passing heartbeat, Pataga slides closer to his high mountains. Do you really want him to vanish into those heights? Do you really want another fruitless campaign?"
He took to drawing more in the dirt, outlining a meandering line that entered the crescent from the north.
"Going by what I saw on my scouting sortie, Pataga and his tribesmen are headed to Nerik via this awkward hill route. It looked slow and winding. But here..."
He marked out a more direct route that cut straight for the open end of the crescent.
"Here's a good path that bridges a ravine and will get us to the plains in less time. It can be done."
General Karunta strode along the edge of the flames, his silver braid swishing, torso glinting in the firelight.
"In my youth, I fought alongside General Nuanza in the eastern deserts, in these forsaken hills, in the western riverlands. The handsome bastard always drew the eyes of the local women."
The thick ring of gathered soldiers laughed fondly at this.
"Yet he was just as cautious with them as he was with foes on the field of battle. Never hasten to battle lest you trip upon your hubris."
Karunta shook his head bitterly.
"Now I rarely heeded his advice. One wink from a Lucan maid, or the glint of raider's armor across a desert wadi, and I was off and running, weapon in hand, if you take my meaning."
More laughter.
"And right now, if I was alone against Pataga and all his spears, I would most likely bound straight towards him, just for the chance to avenge Nuanza's death. But I do not see the Lord of the Mountains. We catch glimpses only of the scorpion's tail of his rearguard. Perhaps, bowman,
He tilted his head to speak into the night sky.
I will agree with you at last. Let us be cautious. Has Pitaga not already shown what an asp he is?
The gathered soldiers seemed deflated at this.
But the wind is in our sails. The prey has been scented,
Volker argued.
From what I saw, Pitaga has only 2 spears for our every 3.
He gestured towards the wagons, which held the disassembled chariots.
And the Hittite chariots will cut across Nerik's plains like harvesters. Hasten for Nerik, I say.
The soldiers erupted in a cry of support. Karunta's face crumpled. Hattu watched his brother's brow knit tighter and tighter, locked in indecision.
Prince Muwa, this is your chance to lead this great army to victory,
Volker persisted.
To secure your reputation as their young general prince.
This seemed to strike a chord. Muwa's eyes rolled up to meet Hattu's, a dark look.
Return to your tents, Muwa said. Come dawn. We take the swift road to Old Nerik.
King Masili heard the clamor outside his wagon. When it faded, he heard his breaths come and go with a weak rattle. He felt like a helpless babe in a cot, with his minders craning their heads in the wagon windows every so often to check on him. Only Volker's root brew gave him nourishment of sorts, but it was an empty nourishment that lifted him for mere moments before giving him a gnawing, fierce need for more. And what was this news that Orax, one of his long-serving Mercedi, had brought him? After he had asked Nuanza to take Volker out on patrol, and the effort in issuing the command had near enough knocked him out, he had sent Orax to look inside the Sherden warrior's tent. Orax had returned a short while later.
I found nothing of note, my son.
He shook his head and chuckled wryly.
But something strange happened when I left the tent. A sentry from the camp perimeter near the western gate bumped into me. He was carrying these.
Orax had held up a clutch of arrows.
A gift from Prince Muwa to Nuanza earlier today. The sentry had found them in the ditch near the gate. They had been discarded there, loosely buried under the dirt.
And now Nuanza was dead, starved of his arrows and slain on the scouting sortie. Masili's head began to ache as he tried to piece it together, to try to find a conclusion that was not as dark as the one which seemed unavoidable. He recalled the dying Zeda's eyes, swiveling to pin Volker. His illness and pains had started not long after the Sherden had joined his entourage. The Sherden had urged the Hittite army to hasten to the Carrion Gorge, had seemingly known the honey in the Hatazuan forests was bad, had robbed Nuanza of his arrows. A horn-helmed head poked in from the wagon window, as if hearing Masili's thoughts, gazing down upon him, the root brew flask in one hand. Masili's gummy lips peeled apart, and his tongue lolled.
Tell me. Tell me I am wrong.
Volker's smile faded.
Ah, I can see your troubled mind needs soothing, he said.
With a furtive look around, the Sherden tipped not a flask of root brew, but the contents of a small vial into his mouth. It tasted like fire, 100 times stronger than the root brew.
This will soon bring an end to your suffering, my son. Drink swiftly. With any luck, you will be numb for what is to come tomorrow. Your divisions will be marching to the plains of Old Nerik, you see, to the land of the waning moon.
Masili shifted his head from side to side weakly, trying to protest. Quickly, blackness filled his mind, and he slipped into unconsciousness. Hattu returned to his tent, his heart roused by the sounds and sights of so many warriors eager to finish this.
The wolves and the storm will fight like gods,
Tanku said to the soldiers nearby as they went.
Pitaga will cower on his knees by dusk tomorrow. The silver likeness will be recovered.
And we will free the temple folk. Save your woman,
Dagon added privately to Hattu, squeezing his shoulder. Hattu patted Dagon's hand in a tacit acknowledgement, just as they rounded a circle of tents to come to their own. There, Sargis and Kizna took hold of each other's shoulders, growling, slapping one another in the face as if battle was but moments away. "Save your ire and excitement for tomorrow," Hattu advised them. "If we let our blood grow too fiery now, we will be spent by the time we come to face Pataga," he said, as he ducked to enter his tent, drawing back the woolen blankets of his bed. "And be sure to drink a good share of what—" But the sentence was never finished as he froze. A mass of dark brown and white feathers lay inside his bed, stained red, shiny and wet. Fright, horror, then heart-rending realization.
"Arrow?"
he said, his voice suddenly like a boy's again. He reached down to lift her with trembling fingers. Her light body was cold, and her head and wings hung limp. Her eyes, those magnificent eyes, gazed into infinity. He traced a thumb down her bloodied breast, finding the savage injury that had killed her. His eyes widened as he saw it was from a weapon wound of some sort.
Who did this to you?
Hot tears splashed on his hands and Arrow's body, and he kissed her head.
"I'm sorry, my friend. I was not there to protect you. I'm so sorry."
He barely heard the forlorn sigh behind him, but felt Dagon's hand rest on his shoulder again.
"Hattu, I'm so sorry. Who did this? We'll find whoever it was."
Hattu lifted one feather that did not belong to the falcon, a grey-leg goose fletching. His mind came alive with fire. He swung round, his face bent in a snarl.
"I know who did this,"
he snapped, his eyes glowering past Dagon, across the night-cloaked camp and to Mua, seated by the great fire. The Tukanti's quiver rested nearby, the matching fletchings jutting proud.
"Hattu, no, surely—"
Dagon started, but Hattu shot up to standing, barged past him and stomped across to the great fire. Mua looked up, his sour face curdling further when he saw his younger brother.
"I don't have time for you, not now."
Hattu felt his hand itch to pull his sword free. He did not, but his mind chewed over and over on the idea.
"Why? Why?"
Mua looked up, eyes like slits, mouth twisted in an uncomprehending grimace.
"Go back to your tent, soldier," he scoffed, waving a hand at Hattu. "Eat your punishment rations."
Many warriors nearby turned to look on.
"So that is it,"
Hattu said, shaking with rage.
"When I was the cursed son, you were happy enough to endure me. Now some men call me the son of Ishtar. You grow jealous?"
Mua stood nose to nose with Hattu, albeit a hand's width taller.
"The last I heard, you were acclaimed amidst a heap of dead children and women at that village. And so you felt justified in what you did,"
Hattu roared, tossing the fletching feather at Mua.
"You don't even care, do you?"
Mua watched the grey-leg goose feather swirl and float between them, his brow creasing in confusion.
"I did nothing you did not deserve,"
he said, glancing over to Hattu's tent, where the wolves' half-rations bubbled away in the pot.
"Go back to your place with the ranks,"
he added, then shoved him hard. Hattu stumbled back a few steps, then rushed for Mua, shouldering him harder, knocking him onto his back. At once a dozen or more flashes of bronze saw Mercedes blades circle the two. Orax and Goru, leading the guard party, looked at one another, unsure what to do. Hattu stabbed a finger towards the rising Mua.
"The shining silver vest of the Tukanti grows black on your chest, brother. Infected by the tendrils of your heart."
Mua shot his brother a wild-eyed look.
"And it would rest more easily on your shoulders, would it? That is what this is all about, isn't it?" "I will never forgive you for this,"
Hattu said, then swung away back to the tents. Chapter 20. Master of the Wolves. Summer 1300 BC. A white raven banked and arced through the cool, dry night air. It swooped down on the lone figure atop a dry bluff, landing on his outstretched arm, eyeing his lion skull helm. Pataga beheld the odd bird fondly, and wondered how he might reward his Sherdan accomplice for this. Perhaps with a swift death, once it was all over. Then he turned his attentions to the flood of men pouring through the defile below. Men of strange blood, odd garb, different ways, all heeding his call, all draped in toughened armour and dripping with copper and bronze weapons. The lost North was united in a way none would believe, until the time came. And that time was approaching. The coming dawn would herald the greatest of days. Others within the wolves offered to bury Arrow for Hattu, but he refused. Instead, while the rest turned in, he remained awake, cradling her in his hands, his throat thick with grief. Eventually, he buried her alone. After that, he slept little, and when he did, he suffered dreams more wicked than ever. In one, he and Muwa were young again, playing in the waters of the Ambar. All was well, Arrow soaring above them. It was a genuine memory, and one he treasured like a gemstone. They laughed and joked, splashing each other, Arrow flying through the spray. But when Hattu looked down, he saw that the Ambar's current had turned red around him. Aghast, he had staggered towards the banks, then looked to the mid-river to see Muwa laughing gaily, holding Arrow's broken body like a prize, wringing her corpse and causing her blood to stain the water. He woke, and for a moment that warm blanket that so often follows a nightmare, the gradual realization that it was not real, comforted him. Then he saw the small, freshly dug mound near the tent. His heart cracked in two all over again. Dawn had broken, he realized. All of the wolves had risen. Every other bedroll was empty. Sargis and Kisner were sitting cross-legged by a recently kindled fire, eating a breakfast of scrambled eggs and soldier bread. He rose and sat with them, knotting his hair tightly on the top of his scalp, unplugging his water skin to drink a bellyful. Damn. No dawn call, he asked the pair, hiding his grief by looking to the newly risen sun and then over the camp, cloaked in a veil of shade from the nearby hills and dotted with men roused and gathered around fires to eat and lay out their armour and weapons.
Karuncha forbade it, Sargis said through a mouthful of bread, for fear that the Kaskans might hear and guess our route.
A wise choice, I'd say. Hattu chewed his lip as he looked west to the curved range of hills there and the soaring mountains just south of them. This was the opening to the crescent from Muwa's dirt map. Cupped between the two ranges lay the plains of Nerik. He saw that his two comrades were not enjoying their meals at all, Sargis tapping a foot and Kisner's belly gurgling and groaning. It set him thinking, and it was a welcome distraction from the sorrow pulsing in his breast. I used to fear every day at the Fields of Bronze, he said, spooning some eggs into a bowl for himself, even though eating was the last thing he wanted to do. I'd wake before the dawn call. You lot would still be sleeping, snoring, farting, louder than the thunder of the gods, he said with a gentle laugh, pointing an accusing spoon at the pair. While my guts would be turning over, my mind wide awake. He took a spoonful of eggs, creamy and rich, more soothing and welcome than he had expected, and smiled. Fear absolutely had me, I admit. A few others had gathered nearby, listening. He felt an added weight of duty to make his words worthy, so he took a swig of water and continued.
At one point I was ready to walk away, back to Hattusa and the Acropolis's halls. I stayed, though, because I sensed that there was something right about it all. True, we were put through torture every day, but we endured it together. Together, we saw it through. We are something special. Aye, we will face the Kaskans out there today. But when the time comes, there is no other group of farting, snoring, daring, and dogged bastards I'd rather stand with.
Kistner snorted with laughter.
Farting and snoring,
Sargis pointed at his comrade, then turned the finger on himself.
Daring and dogged, he said,
then rumbled with laughter too. Others close by chuckled, and some lost that look of fear. Hattu felt his own heart rise at the change in mood. His words had been as clumsy as they were worthy, he realized, but he had brought laughter and smiles to frightened men, shone brightness upon cold black fear. Perhaps a vein of father's aura ran in him after all. But when the laughter faded, The small grave mound hovered once more in the corner of his eye. Hattu felt a renewed surge of sadness.
You should be up above, friend, he said inwardly. Soaring high.
When Kisna and Sargis shared a look, then set down their bowls and stood, Hattu frowned.
Not hungry. We'll finish eating in a moment, sir,
Kisna said. Hattu was confused at the formal address, then realized they were looking over his shoulder at something, eager glints in their eyes. He twisted round to see Tanku, Dagon, and the rest of the wolves with them. With them, also, were eight other captains of the Storm, and Raku, the flat-faced regimental chief. Each of them wore roguish looks that might have terrified him in his early days with the army.
Tanku?
He asked his captain, who led the gathering. Tanku handed him a folded bundle of green cloth.
What is this?
He said, confused.
A change of the watch,
Tanku said. Hattu eyed the cloth. It was the captain's cloak.
This is yours, Tanku, he said, confused.
Not anymore,
Tanku said, taking off his own helm and placing it on Hattu's head, the long trailing black plume dangling to the small of his back.
You are the true leader of the wolves. I noticed it first at Bakka, when you led the climb to warn the rest of the army. Then in the woods, you were sharper than any other and spotted the Kaskan honey ruse. And at that Hattanzuan village, it was you who gave the order to refrain from Volker's slaughter. When I was set to rush blindly into the village and do Volker's bidding.
He leaned close so only Hattu could hear.
And at that foul islet, I froze. You led us when I could not. You didn't do so to garnish your reputation. You did it to protect the wolves.
Any one of us would have done that, Tanku. I was the closest to you, that's all.
Tanku patted his shoulder and smiled. There was not a trace of sadness in his voice or his demeanor.
See? You do not yearn for the power of the captaincy. That is what makes you the right man.
Hattu looked across the sea of faces. Dagon, Kisna, Sargis, all smiling fondly.
I've spoken with the men in the last days. They agree,
Tanku said, taking the green cloak from Hattu's hands and draping it over his shoulder.
It is the way of the Hittite army. 100 elect their captain from within.
Tanku, I can't. You earned this. The Academy tailors made this cloak for you.
Tanku shrugged and grinned weakly.
Ach, in truth, my mother made it for me. She also made me a matching loincloth. But you won't want that, I'm sure.
A low chorus of chuckling rose from the gathered men.
But still,
Hattu protested.
It's yours.
Then he added with a cocked eyebrow.
Though I'll be honored to accept the post of chosen man.
Then, in the silence of indecision, he heard the scrape, scrape of someone sharpening wood. He looked up to see Karunta, sitting on a high boulder, hewing at a stake with his knife.
Will you just take the damn cloak and be quick about it?
The one-eyed general grunted without a hint of a smile.
We've got a Kaskan lord's arse to kick today.
Hattu smiled in his place.
Aye, sir,
he said, sweeping the cloak over his shoulders, then taking hold of two corners of the cloak and tying them together on the right of his breast in lieu of a pin. The significance of the green cloak on his warrior's shoulders was just creeping up on him when Dagon approached.
And this is a gift from all of us,
his friend said, stepping forward to hand Hattu a bronze cloak pin, a single white feather fastened to it. The sight brought a tear to his eye and a stab of pain to his heart.
Arrow,
he thought.
It's hers,
he said, his voice thick with emotion.
Aye. One of the Fury men caught it falling from the sky as she watched over us on the march. He kept it for good luck. From the son of Ishtar and his hunting bird. A fine omen, he said.
Hattu pinned the cloak in place, smoothing the feather fondly.
Son of Ishtar, master of the wolves,
the group said in a low chorus. Other regiments, eating and preparing nearby, stood to see and echoed the call. At once the mood in the camp was lifted. But across the sea of tents, fires, and faces, Hattu saw one, dark as a thunderstorm. Prince Muwa stole through to the wolves' area, arms wide.
"What is this?"
he spat. Hattu's elation faded, replaced by a hardening of his heart and a stiffening of his shoulders.
"Tukansi,"
one of the Fury captains said with a salute.
"Prince Hattusili is now captain of the Mountain Wolves."
Muwa glowered as he looked over the green cloak. Hattu felt his brother's gaze like the flames of a close-held torch.
"Has his captain died?"
"No, Tukanti,"
Tanku said.
"But as is the way of the army, we elected within our group."
"Then this is a nonsense," Muwa growled. "We are out here in the Lost North. Now is not the time to be swapping ranks on a whim."
Tanku tried to interrupt.
"General Karut—"
But before he could explain, Muwa barged past him and snatched out at the pinned right shoulder of Hattu's new cloak, as if to tear it off. Instinctively, Hattu shot up a hand to catch his brother's wrist. It was a shaping moment.
Tall, powerful, Muwa's arm shook, as did Hattu's, a battle of will and strength. "Take off the damned cloak!"
Muwa groaned, as 1,000 gawping soldiers looked on. Hattu felt his arm grow numb, Muwa's grasp hovering over the cloak pin and arrow's feather.
"By Tahunda, by Ishtar,"
he said.
"If you touch that, I will—"
Muwa pulled his hand free and squared his shoulders.
"You will what? Remember who I am, Hattu. Remember who you are."
Hattu saw how his brother's hand had moved to toss back his own black cloak and hang over the haft of his curved sword. Only then did he realize he had reflected the movement, or had he been the one to make the move first? He thought of Ishtar's cruel words. He thought of his oath with father. But the charging horses in his heart defied that vow, and his hand trembled, tensed, and ready to tear his sword free.
"Stop!"
Kurunta barked, sliding down from the high boulder and rushing between them, casting aside decorum and pushing both princes away from each other. The general's face was bent with distress. Masili could barely keep his eyes open. The vial of fiery poison had sent him into an oblivion that he was only now waking from. It was raised voices and a close-by rummaging of busy hands that brought him round, shuffling to push pillows under his neck and lift his head a little so he could see from the carriage window. It allowed him to see Hattu and Muwa by a nearby ring of tents, leaning in towards one another, faces feral, hands hovering over their sword hilts. Only Karunta's arrival put a halt to what might have happened next.
"You see," Volker said, straightening the pillows. "You see how hard I have worked."
Masili rolled his eyes up to the smiling Sherdan warrior.
"Soon you—"
he pressed a finger to the king's chest like a playful mother to a child—
"will be but a living corpse. The root brew has seen to that. Nobody knows how toxic it is. Except you, of course."
Masili's wasted body convulsed once, yet not even a whimper escaped his lips.
"All those who found out about it along the way have been carefully dealt with," Volker continued. "Your physicians, your courtiers, your overly suspicious generals."
Masili's mind flashed with memories of past glories, and he conjured a new one, seeing himself leap up from the bed, grasp the Sherdan warrior by the throat, and then draw and dig his dagger hard and fast into the cur's guts over and over and over again. The fantasy faded, and he felt a stinging, hot shame overcome him.
"I took you in. Me—"
"I cut quite the wretch, did I not? Staked by the anthills in Wahina,"
Volker cooed, his eyes seemingly reading Masili's thoughts.
"Pitaga did not believe you would offer me shelter. Yet he lacks my skills of persuasion."
Masili's breaths escaped in weak half-coughs now.
"Yes, the Kaskan Lord thinks he is my master. True, he employed me to draw your grand divisions onto the plains of Nerik."
Volker smiled and cocked his head to one side.
"And Nerik will be the scene of your army's demise. I will see to it that you and I alone survive, however. Pitaga will then sweep south and plunder all of your lands, and a plunderer is all he is. He would rather topple your cities than secure them as his own. So when it is over, when the fires have died, when the pillaging is complete, when the Kaskans withdraw into their highland homes again, and the remnant Hittite people return to their fallen cities and try to rebuild them, leaderless, they will stare agog as their corpse king emerges from the wilderness, aided by his loyal Galmasedi.
Masili saw tears of unbridled ambition in Volker's eyes. Madness unharnessed.
And when you pass, soon after, the airless grey throne will be mine.
Masili's eyes swept back to the two princes, now being shoved apart by a forceful Karunta, while Coulter did his best to disperse the watching crowds, urging them to prepare to march for Nerik imminently.
Your boys? Aye, they are rightful heirs. But look at them. They will both fall at Nerik, if they don't kill each other before then,
he said with a laugh, as if making a light-hearted remark. Masili closed his eyes, seeing Ishtar's writhing, curvaceous form in the blackness. He summoned all his remaining strength to cry out, but it amounted in only enough strength to open his lips a fraction, soundlessly. Instantly the neck of a vial was pressed there.
There, there, great king. Drink long and deeply,
Volker said, a fresh dose of the poison flooding into King Masili's mouth. Chapter 21. The Plains of Nerik, Summer 1300 BC. The dry, shallow ravine echoed with the clatter of boots, hooves, and cartwheels. Russet dust spiraled up as thick as morning mist. Nearly 15,000 men moved in full armor. Knots of archers scuttled along the ravine sides, wary once more the Pitaga might have lined up a pinch-point ambush, as he had back at the Carrion Gorge. Muwa and the Fury Division led the way. The royal carriage and the small pocket of Mercedes came next, Volker at their head. Then came the storm and the blaze, Karunta leading both in Nuanza's absence. The war horses and the men of the chariot teams straddled the flank of the storm. Behind them, the massive train of ox carts and mules sprawled. The 100 men of the cruel spears had been assigned to march to the rear of these animals to keep them in check, and the mountain wolves had been posted at the head to guide them. Hattu brushed dried dung from his leather cuirass as best he could, then tried to grab the harness of a mean-eyed mule once again, but it slipped from his grasp, and the recalcitrant beast continued to nip at his hands. He'd often pitied the poor sumpter beasts when seeing them driven and lashed by heartless handlers, but now he understood. The supply train was the lifeblood of the column. If the supply train could not move, then the column could not move. If the column could not move, then the campaign would be broken.
Come!
Tanku called just behind Hattu, stamping his spear butt into the ground. The ox he was leading shook its head from side to side, but did not move a muscle, apart from its bowels.
Dirty bastard,
Tanku sighed. When the mean-eyed mule took to biting at Hattu's cloak, his patience snapped. He lifted the herding cane, ready to thrash the beast, but softened at the last, lowering the stick and instead rubbing the beast's muzzle. Finally, its tantrum stopped, and it moved obediently. And in truth, Hattu's fury was not with the mule. He shrugged his right shoulder to toss back the forest-green cape and push the cane into his belt beside his sword, then glowered ahead to Muwa. Not once did Muwa look back. No remorse. Not for any of it, Hattu realized. This was surely the Turkanti's most brazen affront, selecting the wolves to help herd the animals, just moments after he and Hattu had almost drawn their swords upon each other, just a handful of hours after slaughtering poor Arrow. Perhaps it would be best if I fell today, brother, for I fear what will happen if we are to stand before each other again. It was a shout from ahead that scattered his baleful thoughts. The army slowed instinctively, even before the division leaders and many captains gave the order. Hattu saw the end of the low ravine about an arrow shot away to the south. Beyond it was a sea of hazy morning air, filling a huge basin of grassy flatland, cupped to the south by the soaring mountains, and on the west and north by these high hills and valleys. The plains of Nerik, a place of legend. But the army remained halted, and he saw why. Separating the ravine end from the plains of Nerik was a dark, jagged chasm. Across it lay a single bridge, laid with timber planks and edged with a rope rail. Muwa, at the head of the column, raised and flicked a hand. A scout went forward, riding his horse up to the bridge, checking its timbers and the soundness of the ropes, then walking his mount out onto the midsection.
"The bridge is good,"
he called back. Next he rode onto the far side, shielded his eyes and cantered around in a wide circle.
"The countryside is deserted,"
he shouted.
"The heat blurs the air, but as best as I can tell, the land is empty."
A murmur of excitement and triumph broke out along the column. They had done it, reached the old place before the Kaskans.
"Let us hurry," Vorka said. "And the sooner we cross, the sooner we can set up a line of bronze for Pitaga to run onto."
"Forward,"
Muwa barked. The army rolled onwards again. The fury thinned into a column 2 men wide, spilling across the bridge and reforming on the other side. Next went the royal wagon and the Mercedes, the storm, then the blaze. Left back with the baggage train, Hattu waited until Karunta waved them across.
"Bring the pack animals first, then the chariots."
The cluster of charioteers grumbled at having to wait. Hattu jogged forward to head up the sumpter train.
"Now will you behave?"
he asked the mean-eyed mule as they approached the bridge. The creature's ears flicked at buzzing flies, and that appeared to be the closest thing to an answer he would get. As he stepped out onto the bridge slats, he saw that the chasm was indeed a deep, grim cleft, its floor cloaked in shade, somewhere far below. The bridge rocked a little with each footstep and clattering hoof, more and more as he moved towards the central lowest point, his hand running across one of the rope railings. Behind him, he heard worried lowing, braying and nickering from the animals, and a few curses and moans of fear from the wolves. The weight of the sumpter animals was certainly causing more motion on the bridge than when it had just been soldiers.
"Keep your eyes on the far end,"
he called back.
"No point looking down unless you want to go there."
Indeed, Hattu could not tear his eyes from the silvery green meadows that waited on the far side. The breeze gently combing the empty plain caused the stalks to sway like gentle waves. A captain of the Blaze Division stood at the far bridgehead, holding out a hand to take the mule's ropes from Hattu.
"Come,"
he said. Hattu urged the mean-eyed mule on with a muted, "Yah!" But it became suddenly agitated once again, straightening its legs and digging its hooves into the planks, looking back. Coulter, watching from the bridgehead behind, cried,
"Gah! Once they stop, it is like drawing the teeth from a serpent to get them moving again. Use your cane if you must."
"Come on,"
Hattu said, anger rising once more. But the mule tossed its head from side to side, its teeth snapping again, going for Hattu's buttocks this time.
"Curse you to the pits,"
he snarled, turning his back on the destination bridgehead to face the sumpter train and drag at the ropes like a strong man, as most of his comrades and the other animals passed him. Just as he was tiring and ready to bring out the cane, his smoke-grey eye ached, and he saw something. Something very, very wrong. The briefest blur of motion near the northern bridgehead, from which they had stepped onto the bridge. The twines of the rope, curling, spiraling, shredding. Lightning slashed across his heart, and he cried out with a half-breath, "Get off the bridge!" And before the words had fully left his lips, he heard the thick, reverberating twang of ropes giving way. The 50 or so beasts on the bridge, and the wolves entire, erupted in a chorus of panic. At once they thundered forward. Hattu swung round too, bounding for the southern bridgehead. Snap! Twang! The bridge juddered violently and sagged to the left. He heard a scream as one of the wolves pitched, flailing off into the chasm, 3 braying mules going with him. Hattu slid to the left also, but grabbed the right-hand rope rail. Twang! Now the rail slackened in his grasp, and the bridge sagged even more. He leapt for the bridgehead, clasping the Blaze Captain's hand and stumbling gratefully onto solid earth. He spun round to usher the last few wolves and as many animals as he could from the bridge. Snap! Again. Now the bridge groaned, the sound amplified and deepened by the chasm. He saw the two wolves stuck in the midsection, and the 12 oxen and 2 mules with them. Their eyes were wide with terror, looking to him for salvation. "I'm sorry," he mouthed, just as the bridge plummeted, breaking apart completely at the northern bridgehead. The roar filled the land as the men and beasts fell to their deaths. Then the bridge slapped against the chasm's southern wall side, with a shower of splinters and dust dangling like a ribbon. For a moment there was silence. Even the cicadas had stopped singing. Hattu saw, across the way, Coulter gawping, the chariot teams agog, the cruel spears mouthing panicked prayers, and then the many thousands of pack beasts stranded there too, braying and lowing wildly.
"Chariot master!"
Karunta called across the chasm.
"You are well? The animals are well?"
"Well enough, though I might need a fresh loincloth,"
Coulter grumbled, eyeing the flailing ribbon of the bridge.
"Can you see another way across?"
Karunta called. Even as the general said this, all heads were already combing the chasm in both directions, looking for another bridge to no avail. A shushing of armour and footsteps sounded behind Hattu. Muwa, Volker by his side. The chosen prince scowled at the frayed bridgehead and at the baggage train and chariot wing trapped on the far side.
"You said the bridge was sound,"
Muwa cried at the nearby scout rider.
It was,
the fellow stammered, quaking.
"I'll have your belly slit and your guts pulled free, you—"
"The bridge was sound," Hattu interrupted. "Those ropes were thick and new. They must have broken apart under the weight of the sumpter animals," he finished, unconvinced by his own argument. Muwa turned a white-hot look on Hattu.
"Damn you, mule handler!"
"What did you say?"
Muwa growled. Hattu felt his breast quivering again, remembering poor Arrow dead in his hands. "I told you what I saw. If you choose to ignore me, then..."